This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Nick Miles, and in the early hours of Saturday, the 21st of September, these are our main stories. The Israeli military says it's killed the head of an elite Hezbollah unit, along with other commanders, in an airstrike on the Lebanese capital, Beirut. A report on the attempted assassination of Donald Trump at a rally in July has criticised the US security services, saying they suffered a communications breakdown. Also in this podcast, we say goodbye to a master of the voiceover.
Hello! Let's watch some television.
From Grandpa Pig to Thunderbirds, the actor David Graham, who has died at the age of 99. The Israeli military says it's killed around 10 Hezbollah commanders in an airstrike in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The most senior is said to be Ibrahim Akil, acting head of the group's elite Radwan unit. Hezbollah is proscribed as a terrorist organisation by the US, the UK and other Western governments. The Lebanese Health Ministry said nearly 60 people were injured in the Israeli strike on a high-rise block of flats. At a news briefing on Friday, the spokesman of the Israeli Defence Forces, or IDF, Daniel Hagari, gave details of the attack.
Today, the IDF conducted a targeted strike in Beirut on senior terrorist Ibrahim Akil, the head of Hezbollah's operations and the commander of Hezbollah's elite Radwan forces. I can now confirm that Ibrahim Akil was eliminated together with other senior terrorists in Hezbollah's Radwan forces.
Lebanon's ambassador to London, Rami Mortada, told the BBC those responsible for the attacks wanted to impact on Lebanese society as well as Hezbollah.
It's no secret that it's an overwhelming attack. Of course, the effect on Hezbollah is massive. On the Lebanese public at large, it was, again, very overwhelming. I think one of the aims of this attack is to sow division and disarray in the country. By all means, it's a full-fledged act of war, act of aggression. And according to the United Nations, it's a war crime.
Hours later, Hezbollah confirmed its commander, Ibrahim Akil, was killed in Friday's airstrike. Ben Brown heard more from the BBC's senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, who's in Beirut.
The Israelis are saying that they have killed Ibrahim Akil. Certainly, he is a big loss for the militant group. He was a very senior militant commander. Israel is saying they killed him along with his entire chain of command. Now, we don't yet know if civilians have been killed also in this strike. We do know that it took place in a densely populated residential area and that a residential block was basically reduced to ruins. Now, this is an area I've been in. It's always packed with people. This was very close to a mosque. It was a Friday afternoon. We can be sure that lots of civilians were in this area. The authorities here in Lebanon are telling us that 60 people have been wounded. And there were reports earlier this afternoon that 5 or 6 children were missing and unaccounted for. We don't have any further information about that. But all of this comes not just after the exploding pager attacks and the walkie-talkie attacks, which killed more than 30 Hezbollah fighters this week, but it also comes after 24 hours of intense Israeli bombardment of southern Lebanon. That has been some of the heaviest firing that has taken place in the past year of cross-border attacks. And during the course of the day, Hezbollah has been returning fire.
So what is your reading of what Israel's strategy is now? Because we heard from the Defence Minister, Yoav Gallant, saying there's going to be a new phase of the war. And he's tweeted to say that the sequence of actions in the new phase will continue until our goal is achieved, the safe return of the residents of the north of Israel to their homes. That suggests all of this that we've seen this week is part of that new phase he was talking about.
Well, what is very clear is that Israel intends to keep up the pressure on Hezbollah. And in fact, to keep increasing the pressure. We've had the wave of attacks earlier on this week on the pagers and the walkie-talkies that shattered the communications network for the armed group, which of course is backed by Iran. We had a previous high-profile assassination at the end of July when Israel killed the number two military commander in the same area in Beirut, Fuad Shukr. So Israel is making it very clear that it is not reducing the pressure. Now, we had a statement from the Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah after the pager attacks saying that the organization had been hit hard, but its command and control chain was still intact, that there would be retaliation, although he didn't say when. But he insisted that Israel would not be able to achieve its aim of returning residents to areas in the south. And you'll remember, Ben, that about 60,000 Israelis have had to leave their homes close to the border because of this cross-border firing. And indeed, about 90,000 Lebanese had to leave their homes for the same reason. So Israel is making it clear this is the new centre of gravity, as the defence minister has said. The focus has now shifted here to Lebanon from Gaza. What's unclear is how far is Israel going to go? Is it going to go as far as a ground invasion, or is it going to try to keep damaging Hezbollah from a distance and force the armed group into a retreat from the area near the border? So far, there is no indication that Hezbollah is prepared to do that, but certainly it is a very weakened organization over the past few days. But important to say, Ben, that it is still one of the most heavily armed non-state groups in the world.
Orla Guerin in Beirut. Well, as we heard, the Israeli military said it killed the senior Hezbollah commander, Ibrahim Akil. Analysts say he was certainly important within the militant group, described variously as a member of Hezbollah's governing Jihad Council and the acting head of the group's elite Radwan unit, and with a long history of striking not just Israeli but US targets as well. Julian Marshall spoke to Firas Maqsad, a senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. How significant a figure was Ibrahim Akil?
Very significant. The Radwan forces are obviously the special operation forces, pretty much the elite fighting force of Hezbollah. And Akil was not only the commander of that, but reportedly after Israel's assassination of Hezbollah's chief of staff back in July 30th, Akil had also taken on that role. So from late-breaking reports, this is quite a significant hit, particularly that there are some indications that not only was he killed alone, but with the entire command of that special operations unit within Hezbollah.
And that special operations unit, what did it do?
These are the elite fighting force of Hezbollah, sort of the equivalent of the Marines, so to speak, in the United States. Within them is the anti-tank fighting brigades that are deployed in the south, very effective in terms of their firing on Israeli settlements. And so this is the creme de la creme of Hezbollah's fighting force, and it's a pretty embarrassing and devastating blow.
So what would they have been doing in recent weeks, recent months? Are they involved in southern Lebanon?
Very much so. In fact, part of the diplomatic deal that the Biden administration has been trying to unlock between Hezbollah and Israel is the redeployment of that Radwan force some 8 to 10 kilometers away from the Israel border, together with Israel perhaps withdrawing from some disputed points along the border. So the Radwan forces and their command structure have been at the heart of, you know, the cross-border fire that Israel has been a target of, and very much at the center of the negotiations and the deal that the U.S. is trying to broker.
How long has Akil been a member of Hezbollah, and what sort of operations has he been involved in the past? I understand that there was some involvement by him in the 1983 bombings in Beirut of U.S. targets.
Akil is wanted by the U.S. He had been there from day one in terms of Hezbollah's formation back when it was called the Islamic Jihad, really the early days of Hezbollah. And he is one of two, and perhaps even actually the last member of that jihadi council, that sort of top council of Hezbollah that was still alive.
So tell me a little bit more about his involvement in those 1983 bombings in Beirut.
What we do know is that he was involved in planning and in carrying out those attacks against the Marine barracks in Beirut.
But it did result in the loss of a large number of American lives.
Some 230, 240 Marines are believed to have lost their lives as a result of that operation. And it led, I must say, to an eventual withdrawal of the multinational force, which the U.S. and France had been spearheading to try and bring the Lebanese civil war to some kind of a close.
Feroz Makhzadeh, senior fellow at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Later, the UN Security Council met in New York to discuss the crisis in the Middle East after 4 days of intensive Israeli attacks on Hezbollah. The organization's human rights chief, Volker Turk, said he was appalled by what he called the indiscriminate targeting of thousands of people in Lebanon through the explosions of communication devices, and said it violated international law.
International humanitarian law prohibits the use of booby-trap devices in the form of apparently harmless portable objects, which are specifically designed and constructed to contain explosive material. It is a war crime to commit violence intended to spread terror among civilians. I call again for an independent, thorough, and transparent investigation into the circumstances of these explosions. Those who ordered and carried out these attacks must be held to account.
The Undersecretary General for Political Affairs, Rosemary DiCarlo, said that it wasn't too late for diplomacy.
The risk to security and stability, not only in Lebanon, but also in the region, could not be clearer or graver. The Secretary General has already expressed his deep alarm over these events. I echo his sentiments and strongly urge all actors to exercise maximum restraint to avert any further escalation.
Rosemary DiCarlo. The United States has described footage that appears to show Israeli soldiers shoving apparently lifeless bodies from a rooftop in the occupied West Bank as deeply disturbing. The National Security Council spokesman, John Kirby, said Washington had demanded an explanation from Israel and that the video appeared to depict abhorrent and egregious behaviour by professional soldiers. The video was filmed following an exchange of fire in the city of Kabataya on Thursday. Zakaria Zakane, whose nephew was among those killed, described his horror at what he'd seen.
How does it feel to be an uncle, watching the body of your nephew being mutilated? What pain will I live with? What will be the scene? And what will be the last picture of them in my head? I will never forget this.
The IDF has ordered an investigation into the incident. Yolan Nell, who's in Jerusalem, has more details.
The disturbing videos show Israeli soldiers dragging three bodies across a roof and dropping them off the edge. A military bulldozer then appears to pick up and remove the corpses. The Palestinian Authority says the footage shows a crime which exposes the brutality of the Israeli army. In response, the Israeli military said this was a serious incident that did not conform to its values and what was expected of its forces. Under international law, soldiers are obliged to ensure that bodies, including of enemy fighters, are treated with respect. Israel's military says it carried out a counter-terrorism operation in Kabataya, which included attacking a car with a drone. A journalist in the town told the BBC that Israeli undercover troops had surrounded a building. Four men who were inside then escaped to the roof and were shot by snipers, he said. There's been a surge in deadly violence in the West Bank since Hamas's attack on Israel last October, which triggered the war in Gaza.
Yolan Nell. Now to other news. A new report by the US Secret Service over the shooting of Donald Trump at a rally in July has found that a series of communication breakdowns hampered its operations in protecting the former president. The acting director, Ronald Rowe Jr., admitted that the security planning around the rally involved complacency and communication deficiencies.
This was a failure on the part of the United States Secret Service. It's important that we hold ourselves accountable and that we use the lessons learned to make sure that we do not have another failure like this again. We need a shift in how we conduct our protective operations. The Secret Service did not give clear guidance or direction to our local law enforcement partners. There were communication deficiencies between law enforcement personnel at the site.
For more on the failings, here's our North America correspondent, John Sudworth.
The use of different radio frequencies by the local police and the Secret Service meant that Mr. Trump's close protection team weren't aware that the alarm about a suspicious person had already been raised. Had they been, the review says, they may have been able to move him out of harm's way. At a press conference outlining the findings, the acting director of the Secret Service, Ronald Rowe, spoke of a heightened threat environment following the second apparent assassination attempt this weekend in Florida, and of the need for the agency to undergo what he called a paradigm shift.
John Sudworth. Voting season in the US has officially kicked off as people in three states lined up on Friday at early voting polling sites or election offices to cast their ballot. Virginia was the first state to offer their voters that option. Minnesota and South Dakota will also allow absentee ballots to be cast in person rather than by post. Our correspondent Ione Wells talked to voters queuing up in Fairfax, Virginia.
There are still more than 6 weeks to go until the presidential election date, but millions of people in the US will cast their ballots early, some by post and some at early in-person voting sites like this one in Virginia.
We're voting early to make sure that our vote is counted.
We're voting early because we really wanted to make sure that we got out here on the first day. It's exciting. And also, we're going to be out of the country on election day.
From a civic duty perspective, early was better. I mean, you don't know what the weather is going to be like, so you just come out. It's a nice day. Why not?
Early voting is the thing now, so here I am. I think most people have decided who they want. They've seen where the country's going and where it's been and what they want, and I think a lot of people have already decided.
Nearly 40% of the total vote in Virginia was cast early at the last presidential election. Voters in two other states, Minnesota and South Dakota, will also have the opportunity from Friday to hand in absentee ballots in person instead of posting them. Virginia has been a reliably blue Democrat state in the last few elections, but some Republicans have been bullish about trying to flip it. Voters will also be casting a vote for the state's members of Congress and one of its two senators.
Ione Wells. Biodegradable sanitary pads, child-safe cooking stoves, and an app that stops online bullying in its tracks are just three of the scores of new inventions and ideas unveiled in Montreal, Canada. The One Young World Summit brings together future young leaders from more than 190 countries to tackle themes like peace, AI, and the environment. The BBC's Jacob Evans was at the event's opening ceremony.
From the Bell Centre, home of the Montreal Canadiens, welcome to the One Young World Summit 2024 opening ceremony.
More than 2,000 delegates, many in national costume and proudly waving their flags, took to the stage. The all-singing, all-dancing celebration kicked off a three-day summit where people aged between 18 and 35 share their ideas, their solutions and ambitions for a better future. One of them, Hannah Raviti Maipi-Clark, travelled here from New Zealand to pick up her award as the Young Politician of the Year.
Very humbled. For us is a saying, kore te kumarai korero mo tōna kereka, which means the sweet potato will never say how sweet it is. So I'm accepting this award not for myself but for the people around me who've raised me.
Another celebrated participant is Patricia Zanella from Brazil. She's created her country's first 100% biodegradable sanitary pad.
This is the most exciting about it. The difference is that he didn't take 500 years to decompose, just 6 months. We were able to do this using raw materials from Brazil. All the process is really natural and all the fibers are hypoallergenic.
The summit is the brainchild of Kate Robertson and David Jones, who've harnessed some celebrity sparkle from the likes of the singer and movie star Cher, the author Margaret Atwood, Live Aid's Bob Geldof, and even Canada's Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau. David Jones says he and Kate have the highest of hopes for the young participants.
If you come to One Young World, you sort of see the power and its impact. So we've impacted 50 million lives. Kate always used to say, you know, if we get it right, the future Mandela will have come through One Young World and be a One Young World ambassador. So if we've got the great leaders of the world having been One Young World ambassadors, if you have countries not going to war because they met here, the world doesn't need another youth conference, but it needs impact and action. And so that obsessive focus on scaling our impact.
Many of the young people here have refused to be defined by their early hardships. Take Charlotte Magai, orphaned at 10 and a single mother by 16. She dropped out of school. But when her child was badly burned on a traditional Kenyan cooking stove in their slum, she was motivated to act. Her child-friendly stoves can now be found in 2 million homes across Kenya.
Initially, I just wanted to build a more stable stove to limit the risk of burns in children under the age of 5. And while doing more research on that was when I realized that, you know, household air pollution and high cost of fuel were also a factor, and I needed to solve all three. So then I went on ahead and designed a stove that would then go and solve three problems.
The overarching theme here is one of courage and determination to reject the status quo. An ambition to rewrite the rules, to create a society they want to inhabit, and to act collectively and learn from one another.
My name is Jedida Rakwar. I'm from Kenya. I hope that going back home, strived and I get motivation to put in the work moving forward and create an impact that lasts.
Malulile, my name is Sosio Dylan Bawafi and I am from the Kingdom of Tonga. Yeah, I came here basically to learn about how to improve social impact for my people back home and across the Pacific.
My name is Tristan Snyder, and I am from Shawanaka First Nation. One thing that has been really resonating with me is really the power of connection here, but how those lasting connections will be leaving even after this event finishes.
Jacob Evans in the Canadian city of Montreal. Still to come.
This deal may mark something of a makeover for Three Mile Island, which often shares space with Chernobyl and Fukushima in the popular imagination.
Three Mile Island, scene of the worst US nuclear accident, is being reopened to power Microsoft's data centres. It's early autumn in the Northern Hemisphere, and most schools are returning for a new term, but not in the West African nation of Niger. None of the schools there have reopened because weeks of heavy rain and floods have damaged classrooms and left displaced people using school buildings for shelter. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, told me more.
Niger is an incredibly poor country, so if you go into the rural areas, you'll find in the villages that a lot of the homes are made using very basic material, mud walls, and some of those homes have just been completely washed away. And in fact, the government is talking about 95,000 homes across the country that have been destroyed, and they're now having to give out a lot of food aid because people are displaced. They're not able to be near where they farm. But of course, the other problem is a lot of farmland has gone with this flooding. So it's a kind of a double problem. But certainly some of the people who are talking about what's happened are saying that these rains were far worse than they'd experienced in recent years.
To the outsider, we normally associate Niger with drought and desertification. And yet this is evidence that there are far more volatile weather patterns of all different types.
Yeah, we've had frequent droughts where crops completely fail and then there's a real food crisis. And Niger has had many of those. And what's been happening in these countries, very dry, arid areas on the Sahel, in the Sahel region, every year, really, people are seeing it just getting harder and harder because of the dryness during those dry periods and so many crops failing. And that's making life for the farmers incredibly difficult. And then, as you say, on the other extreme, you get these extraordinary torrential downpours that go on for a long time and cause a different kind of havoc for the people. So they are kind of between the two, and they're lurching from droughts to floods. And we're seeing that in other parts of the continent as well.
The thing about schools closing is that school is a safe environment for young people, supposedly. If people aren't in school, the danger potentially is that jihadist groups will prey on individuals.
Well, certainly there have been cases, you know, there's evidence that not just in Niger, but in other areas just across the border in northeast Nigeria, it's the kind of lack of opportunities for young people that is driving them into the hands of these jihadist groups. So young people who before might have felt they had a chance of earning a living either off the land or moving to one of the nearby towns or cities are suddenly finding, A, the cost of living is so high in the cities, and B, farming because of these climate problems is getting harder and harder.
Will Ross. China has fortified its border with Myanmar by building higher walls and holding military drills. as the civil war on its doorstep threatens its investments and its economy. Beijing has also dispatched its top diplomat, Wang Yi, to try to persuade Myanmar's military rulers to return to peace talks and hold nationwide elections as promised. Myanmar has been thrown into fresh chaos in recent months after a China-brokered ceasefire in the north of the country fell apart. Armed ethnic groups have made huge gains, capturing key cities and towns on the main road to China's border, which some believe could be a turning point in this civil war. Our China correspondent, Laura Bicker, has this report from the Chinese border.
Ni hao. It's like a jade necklace. A Burma jade.
Burmese jade traders in China beckon us to their stalls.
Very beautiful.
They're desperate for a sale. 70% of the world's jade comes from Myanmar, and yet they tell us the price has plummeted. Strict COVID lockdowns have ravaged this border economy, and now the war has blocked key trade routes into China. Beijing desperately needs stability if it's to rebuild local businesses. Your country's at war, just accept what I give you, shouts one Chinese man, haggling for a bargain.
Oh yeah, the market's lovely. Got colourful flags all around it.
The local maze-like market has stalls brimming with other goods, from milk, tea to tobacco. The few people that make it over the border to China are searching for peace. They have hopes of prosperity. But stallholder Li Mianjian says it's hard to make a living when so many here are just glad to be alive.
It's really, really cruel. I don't know when things can start to improve. I hope some decent people can tell all sides to stop fighting so the ordinary people can suffer less. Otherwise, it's really tragic for us. You know, the bombshells hit hospitals. People were killed, including women giving birth there.
For Myanmar families with the right paperwork, the Chinese city of Reili has become a safe haven.
From here in the middle of the square in the baking sun, I can see over the border into Myanmar. Scattered around the square are mostly women with lots of their belongings. Some have their papers on the ground as they try to get a work permit in order.
Another border checkpoint. China fortified this once porous border during the pandemic, building higher fences, more checkpoints. Loudspeakers still warn Chinese tourists to stay back from the high steel fence. Just a few miles away, armed insurgents have stepped up their fight against the military regime. A Beijing-brokered ceasefire was ripped apart, and thousands have fled the fighting. In response, China is holding regular military exercises along the border. State media said this is to maintain order. Beijing also dispatched its top diplomat, Wang Yi, to Myanmar to push military rulers to hold promised elections. After long shifts making car parts and clothes, dozens of Burmese workers relax playing volleyball. They've been brought from Myanmar as cheap labour for Chinese factories. Zenong is 31 and fears he would have been forced to fight if he'd stayed.
There is nothing we can do because war is happening in Myanmar. Everything is expensive. Everywhere there is a battle going on, and everyone has to run because of war.
His work here comes with conditions. The movement of Burmese workers is often restricted. And enterprising locals have set up food and karaoke stalls to keep them entertained. The future prospects of this town and these workers are in Chinese hands. As Beijing calculates just how big a part it's willing to play in Myanmar's fate.
That report by Laura Bicker. The owner of Three Mile Island, the site of America's worst nuclear accident, says it plans to restart one of the reactors to provide energy for Microsoft. If approved by regulators, the plant is slated to reopen in 4 years' time. Will Leonardo reports.
This deal may mark something of a makeover for Three Mile Island, which often shares space with Chernobyl and Fukushima in the popular imagination. The 20-year agreement will see a reactor, not the one involved in the 1979 partial meltdown, restarted to produce carbon-free power for Microsoft's data centres. Three Mile Island is located near Washington, D.C., where grids are facing strain from the tech sector's voracious appetite for energy fueled by the AI revolution. The plant's owner said the deal was a powerful symbol of the rebirth of nuclear power as a clean energy source. Microsoft says it hopes to feed the power to enable data center expansion in Chicago, Virginia, Pennsylvania, and Ohio.
Will Leonardo. The actor who voiced many famous TV characters, including Peppa Pig, Thunderbirds and Doctor Who, has died at the age of 99. David Graham terrified children all over the world when he played the evil Daleks in Doctor Who, but he later warmed their hearts as Grandpa Pig. Our entertainment correspondent, Colin Patterson, looks back at his life.
Very good, lady.
Generations of children grew up listening to David Graham's voice. In the 1960s, he was Parker, Lady Penelope's ever-so-loyal chauffeur.
Yes, m'lady.
Driving her pink Rolls-Royce in Thunderbirds. He told the BBC that the way Parker spoke was based on a real wine waiter.
It turned out that he'd been a retired member of the royal household. I think he worked for the Duke of Windsor. And we asked him, you know, what he thought of him. He said, oh, he's a real gent, you know. They don't make them like that anymore. And we just embroidered him.
We are the masters of the earth.
He also voiced the Daleks in early Doctor Who, alongside his friend Peter Hawkins. Last year, at the age of 98, he returned to provide new Dalek dialogue for a restored, colourised version of the original Dalek story.
Stay where you are.
And 20 years ago, he landed a rather less menacing role that would run and run.
Hello!
The voice of Grandpa Pig in Peppa Pig.
Let's watch some television.
David Graham said it was a joy that voiceover work had allowed him to extend an acting career, which included him being a member of Sir Laurence Olivier's company at the National Theatre.
Marvellous!
Colin Patterson on the life of the actor David Graham, who's just died at the age of 99. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Ben Martin. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Nick Miles. Until next time, goodbye.